This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The governor says people should stop thinking that the terrorist group has been completely defeated and be vigilant.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzaka reporting. Details coming up also. Sierra Leone has a new president. And former South African President Jacob Zuma is scheduled to appear in court tomorrow on corruption charges. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Sierra Leone has a new president, former soldier Julius Madabiyu. Election officials say he won over 51% of the runoff vote, while his challenger, Samora Camara, garnered 48%. Biyu also won by a narrow margin the first round of the vote a few weeks ago. About 3 million people were registered to take part in the poll. Olivia Aikland is in the capital, Freetown. VOA's William Eagle asked her how the public is reacting to the news.
The mood on the streets is pretty jubilant. From the moment that the election result was announced, I've seen people running through the streets in groups, singing, chanting, Madabiyu, Madabiyu. Lots of people wearing green clothes, which is the colour of the opposition party. Others hanging out of car windows and car doors, blowing whistles and screaming and shouting. I expect that many Sierra Leoneans will be partying until the early hours of the morning.
Have any of the losing parties said that they would contest the results?
Samora Camara has gone on television and said that his party will not accept the result. He says that there were massive electoral irregularities in the last round of voting. He gives examples of massive ballot stuffing, overvoting, fraudulent voting registers, and says that as a responsible party, it's their duty to challenge. He asks for his supporters to stay calm and maintain peace while they pursue these legal measures.
What can you tell us about Madabiyu? What do we know about his former time in power and his style of governance?
Madabiyu has actually already been in power in Sierra Leone for a very short period of time. He was part of a military coup in 1992. His friend and colleague Valentine Strasser ruled Sierra Leone for 4 years, and then Madabiyu led a coup against him, toppled him, saying that it was not constitutional for him to remain in power for so long without having a democratic election. So then Madabiyu took leadership just for a few months before a democratic election took place, and then Biyo left to Ghana. There are rumours that he left to Ghana because he was paid to go, and there are rumours that he left because he wanted some time out of the country. He ran for office back in 2012, but lost to the outgoing president, Ernest Bai Koroma.
What are some of the top items, some of the top things that must be done that are on the agenda of the new administration?
So in Madabiyu's campaign, he talked a lot about corruption, particularly accusing the outgoing APC party of corruption and financial mismanagement. He says that he plans to open a special division in the High Court to deal with corruption. He thanked the Sierra Leonean people in his speech for voting for change and promised to deliver it to them. Let's see what the next few weeks and months hold.
That was reporter Olivia Aikland in Freetown, Sierra Leone. She was talking with VOA's William Eagle. Officials in Cameroon are calling on communities along the border with Nigeria to remain vigilant following a deadly raid this week by Boko Haram on a military base. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kinzaka traveled to the site with the military and has this report.
High winds blow through Sagme, now an almost deserted village on Cameroon's border with Nigeria's Borno State. The government says dozens of Boko Haram fighters attacked a military base in Sagme Monday, killing 5 Cameroonian soldiers and wounding 3 others. According to the government statement, The militants disguised themselves as soldiers and painted their vehicle to match the colors of the multinational joint task force fighting the insurgency. Midjiyawa Bakari, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, says the attack was the first major raid by Boko Haram in the area in several months.
Nous appelons à plus de vigilance. À plus de vigilance.
The governor says people should stop thinking that the terrorist group has been completely defeated and be vigilant because security information indicates Boko Haram fighters are still active, looking for where they can infiltrate, cause disorder and strike. He says he is condemning such barbaric acts that involve deceiving people just to kill and destroy. No villagers were killed in the raid, but several homes were burned. Most of the residents have fled.
Fifty-two-year-old
cattle rancher Hamidou Garga says his home was destroyed. He says his family lost everything, and he still feels frightened when he remembers the sound of the shooting. He says he is wary of all strangers. Garga told VOA people had only recently started returning home to the village since it was last attacked by Boko Haram in November 2016. The governor said the insurgents may have been seeking revenge following a joint operation in January by Cameroonian and Nigerian troops that freed hundreds of hostages from the Sambisa forest in Nigeria, a Boko Haram stronghold. Military officials said dozens of terrorists were killed in that operation. Soldiers from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger have been battling Boko Haram under the banner of the multinational joint task force since 2015. The troops have chased Boko Haram from much of the territory where it once operated. However, suicide attacks resurged for a time last year in northern Cameroon and continued in northeast Nigeria. Monday's raid on Sangmi points to the continued vulnerability of border communities, even as the government urges displaced residents to go home. Moki, Edwin Kinzika, for VOA News, Fotokol, Cameroon.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma is scheduled to appear in court tomorrow in a long-running corruption case linked to a French arms dealer. Police will be out in force to prevent clashes between Zuma's opponents and an estimated 2,000 supporters of the former president, who call the case a witch hunt. They plan to stage a sit-in vigil tonight, then hold a protest outside the court in the morning. The preliminary hearing is being held in Zuma's home province, KwaZulu-Natal. He faces 16 charges for the multi-billion dollar deal for naval vessels from French company Thales. The deal was arranged in the mid-1990s when Zuma was vice president. Initial charges were dropped before he won the presidency in 2009. Several corruption scandals plagued Zuma's 9 years as president. The ruling African National Congress Party forced Zuma from office in February. In 2010, pirates captured Sri Lankan nautical engineer Sarat Surasena off the coast of Somalia and held him hostage for over 2 years. But after his release, Surasena returned to the war-torn nation to help train the Coast Guard to protect the shores from high seas banditry. For VOA, Jason Patinkin has his story from the Somali port city of Bosaso.
It was meant to be a routine voyage. In December 2010, Sri Lankan sailor Sarath Surasena was the engineer in a 19-man crew aboard the Panamanian-flagged MV Orna. They were sailing from South Africa to India with a load of coal. But northeast of the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean, Somali pirates attacked. They fired rocket-propelled grenades at the Orna and boarded the vessel. Suddenly, Sirisena and his fellow crew members were prisoners on their own ship.
And even we are going to the toilet, somebody comes behind us with a machine gun.
The hijacking of the Orna occurred at the height of the Somali pirate menace, which paralyzed Indian Ocean shipping lanes a decade ago. For the crew, it was a terrifying ordeal lasting 2 years. Sirisena and the others endured hunger and beatings. One crew member was shot, though he survived.
Every day when sunshine, we wake up, we are afraid. We don't know at next time who is going to be killed, who is going to be hurt. But one thing I was thinking, I thought, anyway, whenever if I get a chance to be released and go back to the civilized society, I will try my level best to do something against this human trade. This is a human trade, nothing else. They hold the human and they demand money.
Eventually, Surasena's family managed to raise $10,000 to pay off the pirates. He was handed over to Somalia's government in Mogadishu on New Year's Eve 2012. 2 weeks later, he was home in Sri Lanka. Soon after, the other crew members remaining in captivity were released as well. But Sirisena longed to go back to Somalia. At the time, the UN Office of Drugs and Crime was running a program to train Somali coast guards. They needed an engineer to teach boat mechanics and maintenance. Sirisena got the job.
Believe me, first time I did not tell my wife at that time I'm going to Somalia. So I said I'm going to Kenya, otherwise I will never be able to come here.
Today, he lives in the port city Bosaso, staying in a fortified UN compound due to the war-torn nation's persistent insecurity. So far, he's trained two Coast Guard units in different parts of Somalia that have deployed on the high seas.
One type we call two-stroke engines.
His latest group of trainees are from Galmudug, the same place where he was once held under the guard of a 9-year-old armed with an AK-47, a boy he would befriend during his captivity.
I'm happy over here. My part is to enhance the capability, I mean to say, about engineering. I'm an engineer. And I have a good team in Bosaso, so they are good mechanics now. In direct, I'm participating against this piracy.
Since its heyday a decade ago, piracy has dropped dramatically in the Indian Ocean, thanks in part to local coast guards and deployments of international navies in Somali waters. But Sirisena says it will take more than force to stamp it out forever.
These people are not well looked after. They suffer. In the same time, there are some other people in the same society living luxury life, right? So these people wanted to make money, either in good way or bad way. Whatever we do against the piracy, we cannot totally stop unless we develop the country.
Until then, Sirisena says he'll continue to do his small part in the fight against piracy. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Bosaso, Somalia.
In Uganda, the parliament has approved a government request to pay off a debt owed to Ugandan traders by the government of South Sudan. According to a bilateral agreement, South Sudan is expected to pay back the loan with interest when it stabilizes. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For close to 8 years, a number of Ugandan traders who supplied goods and services to the government of South Sudan have been waiting for compensation for outstanding arrears amounting to $41 million. Under the Uganda South Sudan Grain Traders and Suppliers Association Limited, 10 Ugandan companies reportedly supplied maize and sorghum to 10 South Sudan states under the Strategic Grain Reserve Supplies for $56 million. The government of South Sudan was to repay regular installments to the companies, however, only the first $15 million payment was received. That means $41 million has not been paid due to political instability in the country. Several Ugandan traders have decried the trade deal, which went sour, but have kept looking forward to compensation. Rashid Manafa is one of the traders.
Most of us, we have never gone back to businesses. Most of our members have lost their property to bankers because they were borrowing money from the bankers. And we thought maybe we were going to be compensated 5 years ago. But after a long time, we waited until we put pressure on the parliament by writing more petitions.
Uganda, in a bilateral pact with South Sudan, would pay the traders with a loan. Juba would pay back the loan with 6% interest within 5 to 10 years. David Bahati is Uganda's Minister of State for Finance.
The president agreed that we can pay this on a government-to-government debt.
Parliament has now given a nod to government to push through with the compensation. Parliament's Committee on National Economy said the endorsement followed an overall view that the economy of South Sudan is facing significant challenges characterized with civil war, depreciation of its local currency, declining production capacity, and inflation above 100%. Jacob Olanya is the Speaker of Uganda's Parliament.
Honourable members, I now put the question that the motion, the resolution, Parliament to authorise government to implement the bilateral agreement with the government of South Sudan. Will those in favour say aye? See the quorum. The ayes is having.
Yusa Sechito is a spokesperson of Kampala City Traders Association. He says the approval of the loan and of the compensation comes as great relief to traders who lost colossal sums of money and property.
We believe that this is a beginning good ground for let these 10 be paid, let all those of the people who have been demanding for almost 8 years also be paid. The best is we should carry out further scrutiny of all claims. Maybe since this is a financial year 2018-2019, then we could consider another batch after serious scrutiny.
The money will now be paid out through Uganda South Sudan Grain Traders and Suppliers Association Limited, which consists of formally registered companies that supplied maize and sorghum under the strategic grain reserve supplies to the 10 South Sudan states. Part of it will also go to the Joint Association for the Redemption of Ugandan Traders in South Sudan, which consists of traders with small and diverse claims. Meanwhile, Manafa says Ugandan traders need to utilize markets at the Uganda-South Sudan border as they await stability to return to Africa's youngest nation.
So we are still requesting the Ugandan that they should stop at the border, let the Sudanese come and buy from our border, they go and do the business themselves in their country.
Since 2006, South Sudan has been the destination for almost 20% of Uganda's exports, the largest share to any single country. However, the continuing instability in South Sudan has made trade between the two countries difficult. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's re-election victory raises questions about the country's resurgent authoritarianism and the future of the opposition. In his victory speech, Sisi pledged to work for all Egyptians, including those who did not vote for him. The president added that differences in opinion will be tolerated as long as they are not against the national interest. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi reports.
Michel Dunn, director of Carnegie's Middle East program and an Egypt expert, was not convinced by Sisi's pledge of inclusion and says the real question is about the future of the opposition, which was riding high after the Arab Spring movement.
President Sisi said in the past that the political freedoms that are spelled out in the Egyptian constitution would be observed, but we have seen that that is not what has happened. The opposition that was there in place before 2011 and until 2013 has been imprisoned, exiled, completely crushed.
On the surface, Sisi's victory was overwhelming. The official count gave him 97% of the unspoiled ballots. But despite the government's campaign for people to vote as their patriotic duty and essentially endorse Sisi's policies, turnout was only 41%. And the 1.7 million ballots that were disqualified for having write-in votes outnumbered the lone challenger who was campaigning for Sisi before joining the race. All serious rivals were eliminated or intimidated in the lead-up to last week's vote. Younger voters were noticeably absent, as noted by Andrew Miller, the deputy director of the Project on Middle East Democracy.
Despite the fact that you have more Egyptian voters in 2018 than you do in 2014, the lower turnout rate means fewer people were motivated to go to the polls to vote for Sisi endorsing a second term.
Dunn urged the U.S. government not to congratulate Sisi. She noted that, although Sisi has vowed to respect the two-term limit for presidents, his efforts to consolidate power by eliminating opposition have stirred fears that he may try to amend the constitution. Sisi denied that he discouraged the competition of any legitimate opponent. Andrew Miller agrees and said Sisi's path forward is being eased somewhat because Western allies aren't pushing back amid signs of increasing authoritarianism. Miller said, notwithstanding the alleged human rights violations under Sisi, the U.S. and European countries prefer security cooperation with strategically located Egypt over concerns about democratic values and freedoms of expression and speech. Miller said, Sisi faces major challenges, including the continued insurgency and terrorism in Sinai and elsewhere, and meeting people's expectations of economic improvement. Experts agree that the election has highlighted how much party activism in Egypt has waned due to suppression of media and civil society and closing off the political space. But that would not lead to another popular uprising, according to Saeed Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo.
The issue of a third revolution in Egypt is very difficult and impossible. The regime had strengthened itself. There is a counter-revolution that has controlled the media, the culture. Revolutionists today are considered the enemies of the state.
Sadek said the public is fed up with the instability that followed the popular uprising, and there is fear of the security apparatus that has restored its pre-revolution posture. Experts said, if there is a lesson to be learned from the revolution, it is that political development is no less important than economic development. So, for Egypt to enjoy stability and a better future, there is a need for a regime that succeeds and helps establish a strong political infrastructure that includes a respected constitution, free media, responsible political parties, and a vigorous and involved civil society. For VOA News, Mohammed El-Shinawi, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wyjek Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.